Cricketer for Christ. The first mission I worked for, Hospital Christian Fellowship, they quoted from C.T. Studd all the time. Francis Grimm made reading Cricketer and Pioneer and Fool and Fanatic and other books on C.T. Studd required reading. And I must say, he's one of the most extraordinary, colorful characters as we seek to put feet to our faith. C.T. Studd, Charles Studd, from 1860 to 1931, one of the great missionaries of the greatest century of missions, one of the most audacious, colorful, and incredible missionaries, actually. Now, my source for this is C.T. Studd's Cricketer and Pioneer book, which when I'm giving it in yellow text, it's coming from C.T. Studd, Cricketer and Pioneer, written by his son-in-law, Norman Grubb. When I'm using white text, it comes from Reluctant Missionary, one of the most delightful missionary books I've ever read, written by Edith Buxton, his third daughter. He had four daughters, and Edith Buxton is the third daughter of C.T. Studd, who wrote this book, Reluctant Missionary, probably the most brutally honest, funny, hilarious, and insightful missionary biography I've ever read. Edith Buxton was one of the four daughters of famous English cricketer turned pioneer missionary Charles T. Studd. C.T. Studd had captained the Eton and Cambridge cricket teams, and then he played for the All English in Australia. And he brought back the Ashes from... Do you know what the Ashes are? After the Australians beat the English at cricket, the English burned their cricket stumps. The wooden wickets, you know? What do you call those? They burnt them. And those became the Ashes, and those Ashes were put in a cup. And so whoever would win the next cricket match got the Ashes. And so he was the English team that went to Australia, beat the Australian team, and brought back the Ashes to England, you know, the glory return, things like that. So that's the origin of the whole concept of playing for the Ashes Cup. He was converted during the Evangelical Revival of 1880 under the ministry of D.L. Moody. He gave up everything and went as a missionary to China in 1885. There he met Priscilla Stewart, and all four of their children were born in the heart of China. C.T. Studd was the third of four sons born to Edward and Dora Studd. Edward Studd was dead serious about horse racing. Not content with winning several steeplechases, he set his heart on the Grand National and won this race with his horse Salamander. Charles Studd was raised in great privilege in England. From his earliest years, he was involved in sport, particularly fox hunting, horse racing, and cricket, brought up in this home. Aside from horse racing, the Studd family engaged in hunting in the winter, cricket in the summer. Edward Studd had a first-class cricket pitch made at the back of his house. Obviously, they weren't short of money. His three elder sons grew up to achieve fame at Eton by all being in the same Cricket 11 team together. And Charles, along with his two elder brothers, received the most exclusive education in the country at Eton, where they excelled at cricket, creating a record where each brother captained the Eton cricket team in succession. I mean, when has something like that ever happened before? Life was very pleasant, comfortable, and promising for the boys until their father, Edward Studd, heard D.L. Moody. Nothing was the same after Edward Studd became a Christian. It was 1876, and Edward was invited to hear American evangelist D.L. Moody, Dwight L. Moody. Moody's sermons were described as very much to the point. Edward Studd was 56 years old when he attended Moody and Sankey's outreach in the Drury Lane Theatre. Sankey was the hymn singer, and Moody was this old... he used to be a shoe salesman, and he got converted, and he became the most fiery evangelist of his age from the United States. From Chicago. It was a decisive experience. He experienced a radical religious conversion and his whole way of life changed. In order to express his new faith with all the energy and enthusiasm of which he was capable, Edward gave up all his questionable pursuits, particularly gambling. He invested his immense wealth and influence into winning others for Christ. The boys were shocked at the change they saw in their father. He withdrew from horse racing, then he rode about the countryside to urge his neighbors to come into Sunday meetings. They came in their hundreds, filling up the staircase to the first floor, leaning over the balconies to hear the fellows he got to come from London speak them. Moody himself came. As Edward had never done anything by halves, he now threw himself into saving the souls of his friends and relatives. The evangelical message of those revival days was forthright, and as delivered by Edward, was more like a sword thrust than a message. Are you saved? If not, you're going to hell, and that's a fact. He spoke fearlessly to everyone, and everyone that he could on salvation through trusting in Christ. He gave generously wherever there was need, even the gift of a house in America to his friend D.L. Moody, when he contributed largely to the founding of the Moody Bible Institute, this Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, for the training of missionaries to the foreign field. Edward lived for only 2 years after his conversion. But it was said of him that in those 2 years he had worked wholeheartedly for the kingdom of God on earth. And he accomplished more than most Christians do in a lifetime. I would say more than congregations do in a lifetime, actually. C.T. studied at Cambridge University. And then when his second brother, George, was seriously ill and believed to be dying, C.T. considered, what is all the fame and flattery worth? Vanity of vanities. What shall it profit a man if he gains the whole world and lose his own soul? Edith Buxton described her father, who was known by the initial C.T. He was the third son of Edward Studd. C.T. captained the Eton 11 in 1879 and the Cambridge University 11 in 1882. Later, he was in the English team that went to Australia to retrieve the ashes. C.T.'s team returned back to England in triumph with the urn. In fact, C.T. Studd was described as the best all-round cricketer in England. He's that man right over there on the left. And over here, you can see C.T.'s the one standing with his arms folded at the back. Charles' fame grew, and he is twice declared to be the best all-round cricket player in all of England. Charles studied the world at his feet. While on a cricket tour in Australia, his brother George came close to death through a severe illness, and this affected Charles. Edith remembers her father describing his conversion in these words, "I had the good fortune to meet a real live play-the-game Christian. It was my own father, but it did make one's hair stand on end. Everyone in the house had a dog's life of it until they got converted. He was always asking about our souls, and we did not like it." Attending a meeting of D.L. Moody, C.T. Studd was brought to a position of full surrender to Christ. And from this point on, his life was never the same. And he was possessed by consuming passion to lead people to Christ. His brother George did recover, and C.T. went to hear Moody again. And as a result, he gave up cricket and dedicated himself to saving souls. Now you think today, the great sports heroes in our time are the people who pray on the field or maybe wear some Christian imagery or jewelry or give a testimony of it. But C.T. Studd was the greatest cricket player of his time in the greatest empire of the world at that time. And he gave it all up and he went into missions. Charles now regarded his first 6 years of Christian experience as being in a backslidden condition. Now he yearned to be absolute in his service for God. C.T. shocked his family when he became one of the famed Cambridge Seven missionary volunteers of the China Inland Mission. And here you see C.T. Studd at the top left, all dressed in Chinese outfits, which was China Inland Mission style. He met Hudson Taylor and answered the call to be a missionary to China. In this, he is joined by six other Cambridge students who had made a huge impact on the secular and religious world, becoming religious celebrities known as the Cambridge Seven. I mean, Cambridge, about the most elite university imaginable. And these men were from the best families of England, and they all just threw it all up to go to China for missions. He chose to join Hudson Taylor's mission to China, and C.T. was described as no orator, but he had a forthright manner of speaking, and he was tireless. These seven young aristocrats, two of them famous athletes, another two military officers, forsaking all the comforts of England to work with an until then unknown missionary society in the hinterland of China, was a story the press could not pass up. At least back then they couldn't. The Cambridge Seven helped catapult China Inland Mission from obscurity to embarrassing prominence. And it inspired hundreds of recruits for China Inland Mission and other mission societies. And very soon, China Inland Mission, by the end of the 19th century, was the largest mission society on earth, with something in a region of nearly 1,000, just 900 and something missionaries permanent in the field at one time in China. There was no mission in the world to compare with it in size and influence. And it was a faith mission. Didn't do fundraising. And it accepted women recruits. And you didn't have to have a theological degree to go into the field. And it was run in the field, not from London. So it was groundbreaking, trend-setting in every way. Stanley Peregrine Smith was the captain of the Cambridge rowing team, and thus one of the most famous men in England. The Cambridge versus Oxford rowing teams, I mean, this is like one of the biggest events in English sporting history of the year. And here's one of the most famous men in England. He was also converted during one of D.L. Moody's revivals, and he helped found the Cambridge Christian Union. Stanley Smith was the orator of the seven. Dixon Hoster, the son of a major general, was an officer in the Royal Artillery and also converted during the Moody campaign. He gave himself to Christ as completely as he had previously given himself to soldiering. Cecil Polehill Turner was an officer in the Royal Dragoons, that's the cavalry. His brother Arthur was studying to become a minister. William Wharton Castles was an ordained Church of England minister, and Charles Studd, the most famous of all, was the unbeatable cricket captain, the most brilliant member of a well-known cricketing family. C.T. Studd, as he was pictured at that time. With much fanfare, these missionary celebrities toured the British Isles, attracting huge crowds with much media coverage, and perhaps some of this went to their heads. Because on the long boat trip to China, which is like 6 months to get there, they refused to study and prayed to receive the Chinese language supernaturally. Hudson Taylor warned them that this is one of Satan's devices to keep the Chinese ignorant of the gospel. And only when they finally reached China in 1885 and the Chinese language didn't miraculously descend upon them, did they finally knuckle down to study. In China, they were immediately struck by the degradation that opium had dragged so much of the population down to. Many people sold everything, furniture, roof tiles, agricultural tools. They even sold their wives and children into slavery to pay for their craving for drugs. One of the strategies of the Cambridge Seven was to seek to reach out to the opium addicts for Christ. Here they are literally lying in these places, just smoking the whatever the drug they were smoking and lying in a stupor for days. They'd pay for that and they would be in there in just lying in their own filth. They established opium refuges where addicts could come to stay for the 3 to 6 weeks and find deliverance from this addiction. Each of the seven reacted very differently to China. William Cassells, the ordained clergyman, was appalled by the lack of church rules and within a year left. He and Arthur Polehill Turner left China Inland Mission to found a Church of England diocese in Sichuan. Cecil Polehill Turner also left after a year and became a wandering missionary with the goal of being the first missionary to Tibet. Stanley Smith was soon casting out demons and offending the local Chinese Christians, abandoned the unobtrusive style of China Inland Mission evangelism, began parading through villages with banners and gongs like a Salvation Army band. He eventually embraced the Buddhist ideal of a larger hope, that all humanity might somehow be saved, even outside of Christ. And ultimately, Smith departed from all the doctrinal foundations of CM so seriously, he was compelled to resign. Dixon Hoster was the most stable and successful of the seven. He stayed the course as a wise and patient missionary, serving the Chinese with great distinction, earning their love and trust. Dixon, in fact, succeeded Hudson Taylor as director of China Inland Mission. Charles Studd married an Irish Salvation Army officer, Priscilla Stewart. From the beginning, they suffered severe persecution, and he later reported that for the first 5 years in China, every time they stepped out of doors, they were greeted with curses. The most xenophobic, racist, anti-foreign people on the planet, apparently, are the Chinese. Foreign devil is a compound noun. You know, it always went together. Foreign devil, blue-eyed devil, all that sort of thing. I mean, it was like they were cursed all the time by their neighbors. To cope with such hostility, a sense of humor is essential, as seen in these examples. C.T. Studd presented this parable. Remember the miller's donkey? The miller, his son, and his donkey went to market. The miller rode the donkey all the way, and the people exclaimed, "Cruel man! Riding himself and making his son walk." So he got down and his son rode. Then the people slanged, "What a lazy son for riding while his poor old father walks." Then both father and son rode. And the people said, "Cruelty to animals, poor donkey." So they got down, carried the donkey on a pole, and the people said, "I hear two asses carrying another ass." Then all three walked, and the people said, "What fools to have a donkey and not to ride it." So let's get ahead with our work for God and not care what folks say. In other words, whatever you do, you're going to be criticized anyway, so don't worry about it. As C.T. Studd said, "Had I cared for the comments of people, I would never have become a missionary." Being criticized is part of our job description. Nevertheless, Charles saw many people converted and numerous opium addicts delivered. And his total dedication to China Inland Mission's principle of living by faith was seen when he inherited a fortune of £25,000, which is millions by today's estimation, which he promptly invested in the Bank of Heaven. He gave away his entire inheritance as gifts to the Salvation Army, D.L. Moody's Bible College in Chicago, and to Muller's Orphanage, George Muller's Orphanage. He preached Christ as though he had never preached again, and he preached as dying man to dying men. He gave to George Muller's famous orphanage. He enabled D.L. Moody to build the Moody Bible Institute, what his father had enabled to start. He expanded dramatically. And he enabled General William Booth to send 50 Salvation Army missionaries to India, all with his inheritance. And he kept nothing back for his own needs. And when he suggested his wife keep her own money, she said, "No, I'm not going to have you outgive me." And she gave away her entire fortune too. So when he was, after 10 years in China, he was invalided home with typhoid. And his friends doubted whether he would even reach England alive. "There goes a dying man," the people said. However, C.T. Studd did recover, but he suffered with asthma for the rest of his life. In spite of his physical strength as an athlete, Charles did not enjoy good health in the mission field. And in 1893, he almost died. He was forced to return to England with his wife and four daughters. When in 1895 he returned from China, his family tried to persuade him to join the Church of England, but he dug in his heels. "Father was like that," writes his daughter Edith. "He was not a man to join one particular church. He believed in any church or community which loved Jesus Christ in sincerity." He travelled around Britain, stirring up interest in missions, and in 1896 he was invited to the United States to help launch the Student Volunteer Missionary Union, out of which grew the Student Christian Movement, which launched vast amounts of missionaries into the field. He stayed in America for 18 months. That's a grueling schedule, sometimes addressing as much as 6 meetings a day. Many hundreds offered themselves for missions as a result. In 1900, C.T. Studd moved his family to India, where he pastored a church for 5 years, and he also joined a cricket tour in order to have more opportunities to preach to British soldiers. In India, he had the privilege of baptizing his 4 daughters, and one of those present at the baptism was the famous Amy Carmichael missionary. Edith Buxton describes this Indian summer as our happiest childhood. There were picnics, badminton parties, outings, morning rides, 2x2 with Father. Father was keen that we should excel at outdoor sports, and he did his best to make riders out of us. There were days of monsoon, days of brilliant sunshine at an altitude of 8,000 feet. Sometimes they saw tigers in the jungle nearby. Ill health again forced him to return to England, where his sporting fame still enabled him to draw large crowds. These he addressed in his usual blunt manner. "I once had another religion, hunting the Bible for hidden truths. But no obedience, no sacrifice. Then came the change. The real thing came before me. Soft speech became crude salt. The parlor game became real cricket on the public ground. Words became deeds. The commands of Christ became not merely Sunday recitations, but battle calls to be obeyed. Assent to creed was born again into decisive action of obedience." Upon their return to England in 1906, the girls were shipped off to a school in Switzerland where they learned French. And as Edith put it, "Born in China, home to England, 5 years in India, followed by 1.5 in Switzerland, and now Sherborne." Now, been to actually their home in Sherborne, which now is a Bible college. She describes feeling guilty that she didn't want to follow her parents. "Secretly, I felt at war in myself, undecided, reluctant to throw in my lot with them. Yet I felt a stranger to the world that was shouting its welcome. And poor father groaned because when he took us out, being a missionary, it was not seemly to have such daughters. As to jewelry, we could never pass a shop without flattening our noses against the windows. Dorothy was always the favorite, anyway, with the boys. I felt life was simply not worth living unless I could gain the same attention. There were constant jealousies between us, and we were often at loggerheads. We had come to love the sounds of London. Edith Buxton describes the years leading up to 1914 as a brilliant decade of strawberries and cream, cricket matches, large hats, lace umbrellas, night parties, and her sister Grace was always protecting us and, if need be, taking the blame. In 1908 in Liverpool, a notice caught C.T.'s eye. His friend, missionary Carl Kumm, was advertising a meeting with a post announcing, "Cannibals want missionaries." And Charles laughed. Well, for more reasons than one, yes, they do want missionaries. C.T. stood determined to take up the challenge. His doctors were against it. His wife was against it. His financial circumstances were against it. But he was convinced that God was for it, and that was enough. Muslims were sweeping down over Africa, making converts, and unless a chain of mission stations were made across the center of Africa, nothing else could stop them. Father wanted to start the first mission in the middle of this chain, plumb in the heart of Africa. As Edith described it, it sent my grandmother crying, my mother weeping silently on the third floor of Hyde Park Gardens, her helpless cries of, "Oh, Charlie, how could you?" were of no avail. He set about speaking everywhere that he could gain an opening in order to collect recruits. No offer of speaking did he turn down anywhere. He slept anywhere. At 1910, at age 50, he left alone for South Sudan to explore the possibilities in Equatorial Guinea, joining Church Missionary Society missionary Bishop Llewellyn Gwyn. Interesting, our mission base in Sudan is on Bishop Gwyn College, founded, named after this pioneer CMS missionary, Llewellyn Gwyn. Out of 29 donkeys that went on his expedition, 25 died. Out of the journey, the vision for the worldwide evangelization crusade, WEC, was born. He came back to England as a man on fire. Once more, students were aroused by his meetings, and he wrote booklets in his usual hard-hitting, straight-from-the-shoulder style, including The Chocolate Soldier. We've got that tracked outside in full, unedited, unabridged. As C.T. Studd wrote, "Christ's call is to capture men from the devil's clutches and to snatch them from the very jaws of hell, to enlist and train them for Jesus and make them a mighty army for God. But this can only be accomplished by red-hot, unconventional, unfettered Holy Spirit religion, by reckless sacrifice and heroism in the foremost trenches." However, it stirred up antagonism as well as inspiration, and his doctor declared him medically unfit for any kind of missionary work. His great saying was, "If Jesus Christ be God and died for me, no sacrifice could be too great for me to make for him." In 1911, he presented his Chocolate Soldier message, which is one of the most scathing messages you can ever imagine, at Cambridge University, and the dons filed out in silent disapproval, but the undergraduates were intrigued with his audacity. Edith's comments to me, my father's going on, were quite simply incomprehensible. As a family, we had had enough adversity. To go out and seek more was sheer madness. There was no doubt that he is a man of extraordinary vision and compelling presence. His messages were charged with challenge, humor, and emotion. But it was his realism and his living out his own message that attracted those who were looking for sincerity in a world of fashionable poses. It was at this stage that Edith's fiancé, Alfred Buxton, who was studying at Cambridge University to become a doctor, volunteered to join C.T. Studd's Heart of Africa mission. He took her fiancé to one of her dad's meetings, and he ended up being his first and only recruit. And she was so blood-furiously angry with her fiancé, and her father, of course. And naturally, this caused a hue and cry from the Buxton family, who said how unwise it was to go with this harebrained man, as some called him. At the Furville meeting in 1913, at which C.T. Studd and Alfred Buxton were to speak, C.T. spoke with his usual aplomb and zest. The difficulties were great, but he didn't care a brass button. Edith commented, "Off to Africa they went, one too old and one too young." In 1913, he set out again for Central Africa, this time accompanied by his youngest daughter's fiancé, young Cambridge graduate Alfred Buxton. Together, they were the pioneers of the Heart of Africa mission, which became Worldwide Evangelization Crusade, or WEC. They followed in the footsteps of Henry Morton Stanley through Kenya and Uganda into northeastern Congo. Soon Edith was again in the swim of my frivolous life, tea as you only find in Scotland, scones of every kind, butter in glass dishes, homemade jams and cakes baked to perfection. Fun and laughter were everywhere. Life was bright and gay. How easy to stay and be caught up in this life of grace and ease. Edith volunteered to work with the Salvation Army Mother's Hospital and worked in the wards for 6 months, learning all I could. The first baby case I attended in the theatre laid me low on the floor. She fainted. Landing at Mombasa, C.T. Studd and Alfred Buxton travelled by bicycle throughout the Congo. Father trained his mind from early days to look upon every problem as an opportunity. In fact, I've known him to say he welcomed tight corners just to see how God would get him out of them. Bicycles, cried the trader. You mean to say you're going to bicycle through the jungle? Certainly, said C.T. We'll get to the other side more quickly, and when they can't carry us, we will carry them. He had an answer for everything, and he had a faith big enough for any situation. On the incredible trek across the continent, they faced cannibals, wild animals, tropical diseases, the maddening zing of mosquitoes, strange night sounds, the fierce Balenga tribe who had killed Emin Pasha. They were warned that they would never get through the Balenga tribe alive. Hair-raising experiences such as that of the English elephant hunter who had recently been shot with a poisoned arrow by the Balenga and died failed to deter C.T. and Alfred. They'll be too interested in the bicycles to do anything to us, he said. Massive trees so tall they turned the midday sunshine to twilight. Vegetation steamed with heat. Monkeys swung and gibbered at them. The myriad sounds of tiny insects, birds and creaking branches, they felt as though 1,000 eyes were staring through the thick bushes, watching them. They were lost in the primeval forest. They met cannibals with filed teeth, filed down to sharp points. They suffered repeated bouts of fever. C.T. referred to fevers as like being repeatedly dunked by the devil. The fever mounted, the weakness increased, all the medicines failed. If they're any sick, let them call for the elders of the church and let them anoint you with oil. But where's the oil? Neither salad, olive, nor even linseed oil did we possess. Well, what's the matter with lamp oil? Why not? It's oil and that's all that the book says, so we can't afford to be narrow-minded. C.T. then recorded, this I know, next morning, that whereas I was sick, nigh to death, now I was healed. He said, there was no elder to call, there was just the younger, but he'd have to do. And he was healed. They travelled through the Ituri forest, where Stanley once travelled. The forest was very beautiful in place, like marching through an endless cathedral. They travelled through territory where a Belgian officer with a troop of soldiers had been massacred to the last man by the cannibals. To these very cannibals, C.T. and Alfred preached. Their first baptism took place in a crocodile-infested river. And while the missionaries were baptizing the candidates, they were having to fire into the water to keep the crocodiles at bay. C.T. literally baptized with a .38 revolver in one hand while doing the baptism with the other. As he suffered malaria and other attacks, C.T. wrote, some like to live within sound of church or chapel bell. I want to run a rescue shop within a yard of hell. In 1916, he left England for the last time, taking with him a party of 8 missionaries, including his young daughter Edith, who decided that she was going to forgive her fiancé, and was coming out to marry him, to marry Alfred Buxton. Later, another daughter, Pauline, with her husband Norman Grubb, joined the mission. Soon the number of missionaries had grown to 40. And before the end of his life, WEC was the largest mission in the world, even overshadowed China Inland Mission. Edith Buxton described herself as a reluctant missionary indeed. When she was 24, she joined her father on the SS Elizabeth to travel to the Congo and marry Alfred Buxton. I'll die. I know I will die. I shan't be able to stick it, she wrote. At one of their first service in the Congo, she remembers the words of one hymn. Death cometh once. Hear now his tread. Soon shall you and I be lying each in our own narrow bed. And she remembered wondering which one of us will death pick first. During the eventful four-month journey up the Congo River, Edith lost her engagement ring while throwing water out of a wash basin overboard. My engagement ring flew off my hand, plopped into the mighty Congo River, and she felt this was a bad omen. More than 4 years had passed since I'd seen Alfred. Immediately I held my breath. So acute was anticipation, the dread of what I might feel. Imagine 4 years, hadn't seen a fiancé, and she is angry at him most of the time too. However, the reunion was warm and better than anything she could have expected. After the river journey, there's another month trek on foot. If you were to draw a line straight through the center of Africa from north to south and again from east to west, there would be Nala, just south of where our base is actually in Sudan, just in the northernmost point of the Congo. She found Nala a clean, tidy, well-spaced village, avenues of palm grown years ago by the Belgians, interspersed with small and big houses, a church and a schoolhouse. They were all built of mud and thatch in a simplest fashion, and all of this had been Alfred's work. And into the bargain, he'd complete the first stage of writing the Bangala vocabulary. They sometimes travelled by canoe and past herds of hippopotamus. They then had to trek to Nangara, where the district commissioner, the Belgian district commissioner, was waiting to conduct the first white wedding in the heart of Africa. So far, the Belgian officers were not permitted to have their wives with them because this part of the country was not considered civilized or safe enough. Father was quite blatantly unconventional. The church at home he had thought had become more of a building than a way of life. He had not been ordained. He read in his Bible, which was a constant guide as to how the early Christians went about things, and he'd do the same. So he baptized, dedicated, married, gave communion, buried them in a simple African village church. Morning prayers were at 7 a.m. when the whole village would turn up. Work began at 7:30 or so. They'd raise the roof with the hymns of Moody and Sankey translated into Bangala. Once a man got up and told us a story of such relish that every head turned in his direction. I was so interested, I whispered to Alfred, "What is he saying?" Alfred replied, "He's just told us he's sorry he has to confess he has eaten his uncle." The prayer meeting every Friday night was a thing to remember. Outside in the dark, the palm trees rustled gently in the breeze. Inside, you could see some 200 bowed figures, their oiled bodies shining in the light of the palm oil lamps. Gemisi, the converted cannibal and ex-soldier, was the church warden. He had taken upon himself the duty of prowling around. If by any chance he caught anyone with their eyes open, he'd give the heads a good duck-a-tong. That is no way to behave in God's house. When a man went on praying too long, carried away by the new, wonderful experience of talking to God, my father would say, "Now we'll sing a hymn while our brother finishes." Father always said that as long as we missionaries travelled first class, lived out of tins and ate bread and butter and drank tea, the world would never be evangelized. We learned from the Africans how to make oil from flying ants. We made sugar from sugarcane. We took to making packing cases into furniture. We were always warned not to get so posh that it would make barriers between us and the Africans. Aside from cannibals, there were occasional incidents with leopards, crocodiles, and snakes. And after a leopard sees someone, C.T. Studd took to sleeping with a pistol under his pillow. At the end of their second year in Africa, Edith's daughter, Susan, was born. C.T. Studd took an original precaution. He had made an arrangement with a drum of each village between Nala and Nangara, where the only doctor was. And after Susan was born, Africans swarmed to see her, gazing pop-eyed at the first white baby they had ever seen. Susan was a very aware child. On one of her journeys by canoe, she shrieked like a 16-year-old every time we shot the rapids and whirled into the cascading torrents. Ganutu was a big, strong Azandi who walked 200 miles to come and hear about God. I've always wanted to know about God, so my wife and I have packed up at once, and here we are. When is the first lesson? He never missed a meeting, whether early morning one with the workmen or the Friday night prayer meeting or the Sunday services. He was always there, sitting silently with an intent look on his face. Soon he was taking part in the prayer meetings. His prayers were short and eager words. I felt the presence of God amongst us in the quiet night. He quickly rose to become a leader and finally became the head of the boys' school. Edith also relates of a man at Ibambi who had died and been carried to his grave when he sat up with cries of terror. Everyone scattered in every direction. The man told a story. "I've been with God. He knew my name. And that I'd heard the gospel at Ibambi. God said, you shall go back to your village for 10 days. Send for the preacher, accept the message, then you'll come back to me." 10 days later, he declared, "Now I'm going back to God." Then he very simply lay down and died. Jabori, an Azandi chief living near Nala, related to Alfred that one night, many years before the missionaries had arrived, God had met him in his sleep and said, white people will come. They will come with a message from me. Listen carefully and do what they tell you. Until then, only do what is right. Another man, Maiai, had no ears. One day, Edith could restrain herself no longer and asked, Mai, where are your ears? Madam, I've eaten them. Eaten them? I exclaimed in astonishment. Yes, eaten them, said Mai calmly. Long years ago, I was a slave in a chief's village. My life was hard and I did much work and was never paid. One day I talked with one of the chief's wives and together we decided to run away. The chief sent his soldiers after us. A big pot was put on the boil and I saw the woman laid in the ground and dismembered limb by limb and limb by limb put into the pot to boil before her own still conscious eyes. And slowly she is quartered and boiled up to be eaten and it was my turn next. Suddenly into the circle comes the chief's head wife. Gesticulating wildly, she says, O chief, it is not good to eat a child. Curses will come upon us. We shall die. My fate was turned, and instead the chief gave judgment that I'm to eat my own ears. Ah, madam, it was terrible, and I was very, very ill for days. On one Sunday evening, word arrived that Nancy from the girls' school had been caught by Chief Abiyangama on her way back to school. He had kept her prisoner. We have already been to the village to demand her back, but he will not let her go. Nothing appealed to my father more than an adventure of this kind. He immediately ordered the alarm to be blown on the bugle in the centre of the parade ground, and wasn't long before all the Christians of the village poured out. Father from the top of the steps addressed the eager crowd. He was no pacifist, but on this occasion he ordered everyone to lay down their weapons and go to the rescue of Nancy as Christians, not as soldiers. There was a murmur of disappointment in the crowd. It must have been an hour's trek through the forest before we came to the chief's village. But long before our arrival, we heard the drums beating and the grunting cries of the dancers, and as we approached, we saw a circle of about 200 men dancing, oiled bodies gleaming, and a bunch of feathers in every head. They swayed in time to the drum. Father orders men to break through the circle, and we all poured in after him. They stopped opposite the chief, and Father, seizing the chief by the beard, demanded the return of Nancy. The chief backed away, saying, I'll fetch her, but Father, not to be taken, and followed in pursuit. The Christians fell upon the tribesmen with their bare fists. There was never heard such a thumping and pounding. In the darkness, all you could see was the feathers of the warriors and the flying shirt tails of the Christians as they laid into one another. One of the chief's wives made her way on all fours through the melee of legs until she reached Father, when she quickly took his little finger in her teeth and bit it as only a cannibal can. I gave her a thump which sent her sprawling in the dust. Nancy took advantage of the noise to escape back to Nala. I mean, where do you get reports like this? It's like the most brutally honest missionary biography ever. As Edith said, there's no place like Africa for finding it out. An inner voice began to speak. What are you doing? When man listens, God speaks. God can speak to the human soul through the enlightened conscience. I began to put things right as far as I could see. And with my obedience to what I believe God was trying to say to me, there came a change. A sense of God's presence. I experienced a new peace and relaxation in the battle of life. She described Alfred as with such quick intelligence, able to work 16 hours a day, able to eat anything, able to sleep anywhere, to do it without anything. We had 6 years of complete and happy companionship. But then he started to have epileptic fits. After his first illness, there followed 16 years of ever-deepening anxiety, sleepless nights, and further attacks, which Alfred took with a complete and silence that was complete. Father had made so many sacrifices of himself that it was in his nature to expect much from others, and most of us could not keep up with him. If missionaries did not come up to scratch, Father felt we were better rid of them. Alfred played the part of the peacemaker. The same thing happened in case when African Christians had fallen into sin. Father would demand the necessary church discipline. Alfred would advocate patience and love. Each was representing the truth of the gospel, but the differences became severe. Without holiness, no one shall see the Lord. Father had been trained in law, and his letters could be very severe. He would not put off his calling by anyone, even his wife. My father once said, you only need 1 inch of theology to every foot of practical Christian living. At 70, he mastered King Gwana and was able over the years to progress in the translation of New Testament to Psalms and extracts of Proverbs into African guana. In 1928, C.T. Studd wrote, "As I believe I'm now nearing my departure from this world, I have but a few things to rejoice in, and they are these. Number one, that God called me to China and I went, in spite of utmost opposition from all my loved ones. Number two, that I joyfully acted as Christ told the young, rich young man to act. Number three, that I deliberately at the call of God when alone gave up my life for this work, which was henceforth to be for the Sudan only. Not only for the Sudan only, but for the whole unevangelized world." Remember, Sudan at that stage was understood to be anywhere in the hinterland of Africa, even though he is in the Congo. Many of them called it Sudan Interior Mission, for example. "My only joys, therefore, are that when God has given me work to do, I have not refused it." To the end, Charles maintained a strenuous routine. He worked an 18-hour day. He undertook long journeys. He preached sometimes to congregations of 2,000. He read the Bible for hours each day and poured his heart into prayer. Then the news arrived that his wife, who had been left behind in England because of ill health, had died. Charles now suffered several heart attacks and gallstones. In July 1931, this gallant and unconventional cricketer's innings came to an end. In 1931, near Atura Forest, where he had once been entertained by cannibals, he died. He died the good soldier that he had lived, surrounded by the African people he loved and whose lives he had done so much to change. It was a stormy day when they laid him to rest. 2,000 people from the surrounding forest came to his village, including chiefs. In assessing this incredibly bold, abrasive, and controversial missionary, his co-workers, including his sons-in-law, Alfred Buxton and Norman Grubb, great missionaries in their own right, recognized that his energy, earnestness, and single-mindedness made him a most difficult person to work with. He was stubborn and inflexible in what he required and demanded of others. He was eccentric. He wrote a booklet in which he said he didn't care a damn about anything except to serve Christ and save souls. And that kind of language was most offensive and unacceptable to many. And that's, in fact, the title of the book, Don't Care a Damn. And he would often put behind his name DCM, you know, the Don't Care a Damn, the DCD, in cities of the order of DCD. And he'd often say, you know, when people ask, what degrees do you have? No, of course he had degrees, but he said, BA and RFA, born again, ready for anything, which became the terms of Hospital Christian Fellowship. Are you BA? Are you RFA? And of course, fortunately, we didn't have Francis Grimm insisting that we be DCD as well. And he said, I can't abide cowardice. I refuse to make my God and Savior a non-entity. So he was always at loggerheads with someone. He was ruthless in the standards he set for himself and for others, and he interpreted leisure and recreation as idleness. He laid a powerful emphasis on the need for holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. I don't think anyone made a greater impact on Francis Grimm than C.T. Studd. And so the mission I was trained in, Hospital Christian Fellowship, had C.T. Studd as, here's the gold standard up there that you've got to attain to. People were not sure what to make of this man, who in his 50s could leave behind an ailing wife while he went to be a missionary in the most inaccessible and dangerous part of earth. His love for Jesus Christ was supreme, and to many of his contemporaries, he was a fanatic. And hence, one of the books on him is Fool and Fanatic. He said, everyone was happy when I was a fanatic for cricket, and people were proud to call themselves a cricket fan, which is short for fanatic. But he said, when I showed the same dedication for Christ, I was called a fanatic. He said, why is it acceptable to be a cricket fanatic, but not acceptable to be a fanatic for Jesus? So these are C.T. Studd's kinds of terminologies. The mission he founded, WEC, has grown to be one of the largest missions in the world today. Although they've changed the name from Worldwide Evangelization Crusade to Worldwide Evangelization for Christ after 9/11 because they don't want to offend the Muslims. C.T. Studd wouldn't have cared a damn about offending anyone, especially not the Muslims. He chose the name Crusade for good reason. The life of C.T. Studd will always remain a challenge to those who seek an easier path. C.T. Studd's life stands as some rugged Gibraltar, a sign to all succeeding generations that it is worthwhile to lose all that this world can offer and stake everything on the world to come. His life will be an eternal rebuke to easygoing Christianity. He has demonstrated what it means to follow Christ without counting the cost and without looking back. CT was essentially a cavalry leader. In that capacity, led several splendid charges, such as when CT and Stanley Smith went with the Cambridge 7 to China in 1885. 10 years later, when CT toured the universities and started the student volunteer mission. And when in 1910 he initiated the campaign for the regions between the Nile and Lake Chad, the largest unevangelized region in Africa at that time, which of course included much of Sudan and the Congo. These three things alone have affected missionary history. He personified the heroic spirit, the apostolic abandon. From him, I learned that God's idea of a saint is not a man primarily concerned with his own sanctification. God's saint is 50% a soldier. I'm quoting straight from Edith Buxton, his daughter. Anyone can be brave once. It is sticking to it that counts. There's a price to be paid for dedicated, selfless service, such as Father and Alfred gave to Africa. By the way, her husband, Alfred Buxton, went on to Abyssinia to translate the Bible into the Amharic language and to present it even to King Haile Selassie, and served wonderfully there, and was in Abyssinia when it was invaded by the Italians. A very brave man, Alfred Buxton. As C.T. Studd declared, only one life, it'll soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last. So now you know the life of the person who gave us those great quotes. And this is one of the chapters in our Great Essential Missions book.